Hello, my friends. Welcome back to another episode of the Year of Plenty podcast, the show for all things real food and the processes that bring it to the table. As always, I'm your host, Poldy Wieland, and in this week's episode, I talked to Victor from Brazil, who spent most of his life learning about environmental science, sustainable food systems, and syntropic farming. Syntropic farming is actually the main focus of our conversation, and Victor and his friends were actually the very first people to start a syntropic farm in Australia, and now he currently runs the website syntropicgardener.com with an aim to really teach these principles to more people out in the world. Syntropic farming is all about creating life through systems that bring together landscapes, flora, fauna, and humans in harmony. And unlike the industrial agriculture that's producing most of our food today, where biodiversity and human engagements are largely being removed from the system, syntropic farming really aims to utilize biodiversity, to encourage healthier ecosystems from which we can then harvest delicious food ingredients. And in syntropic farming, humans are actually seen as the stewards of the land, you know, who manage and accelerate growth while also creating balance. But I will have Victor explain a lot more of that to you guys in just a second. Let's go over a quick episode overview. So first, Victor shares his background into environmental science and how he really got into thinking and learning about these sustainable food systems. Then we talk about syntropic farming, what it is specifically, and how it got started. Next, we get into this idea of syntropy versus entropy and how all that fits into natural cycles. Since syntropic farming is part of regenerative agriculture, we also talk about how these syntropic principles and doing things in a syntropic farming way can really regenerate soil. After that, we talk about how you guys can really apply some of these syntropic farming principles at home in your garden. And finally, Victor shares one of his favorite traditional Brazilian real food recipes. Now, sadly, the internet cut out a couple times and, you know, caused maybe a little lag, a little distortion here and there, but it worked really well, I think, until like the last 15 minutes of our conversation. So I'm sorry if this impacted the quality of the talk of this podcast, but bear with us because Victor really has so many important and interesting insights into the world of syntropic and regenerative farming that I think all of you can benefit from. As always, this is the Year of Plenty podcast. If you enjoy it, smash that subscribe button on whichever platform you use to listen. Make sure you leave a 5-star written review on Apple Podcasts. That's one of the best ways to help support this podcast. And you can also make a small donation on Patreon with the link in the podcast description. If you don't know, Patreon is a service that allows you to help me create the show with donations as little as $2 a month. And the cool thing is, it's all based on this patronage system that was super popular during ancient times. You know, back then, kings and queens alike used this system to really take creatives under their wing and support them in exchange for value. So if you do get value from the podcast, consider going on Patreon and making that small donation. Otherwise, you know, sharing it with your family and friends, that's a great way to help support the podcast as well. And if you want to, you know, go over on Instagram, follow me there. It's at Poldy Wieland. That's where I post a lot of my own pictures from my wild food journeys, just some of the things I'm cooking, and just additional free content that's supplementary to this podcast. So definitely check that out if you're interested. And I'm glad to hear from you there, engage in some conversations, because, you know, this is all about exploring real foods together. All right, that's it for this intro, though. Thank you for sticking around. Let's get started. Get ready to learn from Victor. All right, Victor, is it Pires, Pires? How do I say it?
Well, in Portuguese, it would be Pires. Pires. But in English, I'm still trying to, you know, some people call Pires or Pires or whatever. Just call me Vic.
Vic, I like that. That's a good nickname. You are in Australia right now, right?
Yep.
17 hours, I think, ahead of me. So I'm happy we could make this happen.
So easy, me too. Thanks for having me.
Oh, for sure, man. So you are a I would, I mean, you call yourself a syntropic farmer, right? But you farm, you garden. And I read your blog post that you posted. I think it was one of the Facebook groups that I always go through. And I was just, I saw it and I'm like, wow, I need to learn more about this. This sounds really, really cool. A great job on the blog post, by the way. It was really well written. So we'll get into syntropic here, but why don't we just start out by you telling us a little bit about your background, your journey, and, you know, growing up in Brazil and your where you went from there, you know?
Yep, absolutely. Well, from São Paulo, Brazil, you know, mega city, probably not one of the most inviting natural places to be on earth.
Yeah.
Hectic. But I was fortunate enough to come to Australia when I was 17. So basically I finished high school and came over. And the idea was mainly to, you know, spend a year or 6 months and learn a bit of English. And 20 years later, I'm still hanging.
So why Australia?
Oh, look, it just came out of the blue, really. You know, my aunt had spent a bit of a holiday time here. And she said, oh, why don't you check it out, Australia? They seem pretty similar to Brazil, you know, kind of southern hemisphere, I guess, and similar climate. And I remember her saying, oh, and they love barbecue. So I go like, all right, let's see how that goes. You know, that's how the seed was planted, I guess. And then we just started to look into what options there was. And I came over with my cousin and her partner at that time. And yeah, just kind of loved the place. And 1 year passed, another year passed, started to do a university, did environmental science. And so started to get a bit more knowledge on the environmental causes and problems and solutions and whatever processes. And tried to go back to Brazil after about 5 years and didn't quite work. Brazil wasn't ready for me anymore, I guess. And then I came back, did a master, did a PhD, and just, you know, hang around and became an Australian citizen, which I'm very proud to be as well. I'm very, very happy to be welcome in this, you know, wonderful country as well.
I know, I've never been. I've heard great things. My cousin actually went for like a work and travel and the same situation where he, you know, he's going to go for like a year and it ended up being, I think, 4 years or something like that. Just working on farms and then, you know, using that money to travel throughout Australia, which sounded like an awesome thing. It's definitely on my bucket list. So you just mentioned you did your bachelor's in environmental science, right? And then you did a master's and a PhD. What were those in?
Yeah. So the master's was in environmental planning and the PhD as well in environmental planning, but my focus was on urban agriculture. So what I wanted to do was to try and facilitate. So it was more kind of a top-down approach, let's call it, more working with councils to try and create policies that allow more urban agriculture to happen. Because it's urban agriculture in my experience is such a gray area that, you know, people do it, but it's kind of, if you're going to go into the nitty gritties of the legislation, it's usually kind of illegal.
Really?
You can grow a bit of veggies on your backyard, but as soon as you want to, you know, let's say you have a mango tree and you have a couple of boxes of mango, what are you going to do? And you want to have a little store in front of your garage, it's actually illegal. You know, there is a whole planning process that you have to go through it. If you want to go there, and then you have to have, you know, a traffic assessment and a parking assessment and all those kind of studies, which will cost, you know, 50 grand just to be able to sell your mangoes. Of course, it doesn't really happen, but, you know, it's a gray area that it's possible that if the neighbor complains, then, you know, council shows up and da-da-da. So it's, my idea was just, you know, can we just add a few little definitions into, you know, the planning schemes and just a few activities that would become permissible, and then would just invite people to start doing it. You know, things dealing with farmers markets and, you know, growing food and selling a little bit of food and composting and that kind of stuff. Just trying to decentralize a bit. There is so much resources that are just shifting from one place to the other that you can just give it to your neighbor and there you go. It's being used rather than, you know, transiting the planet. So man, that was my... more the idea, yeah.
I'd love to get into that a little bit later because I've been thinking about and reading up on this, you know, the food system in general and trying to figure out how can we decentralize it? How does that all work? And yeah, maybe we can definitely get into that later on a little bit more. But was there like, was there a moment in your life? I mean, if you like, you made this your career, right? Or I mean, you're going to college for urban agriculture, doing a PhD in it, trying to actively change, or you're trying to get some sort of influence so you can maybe change laws, right? I mean, that's a pretty big step. What was it that really got you interested in this in the first place? To even just do your, you know, just to your bachelor's even.
Yeah, look, it's hard to know. I mean, I was always a guy that was, you know, wanting to spend as much time outside as possible. But in Brazil, even outside, it feels a bit inside, you know, because there will be always a gate around, or you're kind of inside a club or something like that. And I think when I came to Australia, you know, the environment just started to, you know, it's so empty here relatively to Brazil. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you just start to forge perhaps a better relationship and start to understand a little bit of those feedbacks that happen as you interact with it. And then, of course, doing a Bachelor of Environmental Science was really interesting. I really enjoyed it. But it was also so broad that you kind of go, I know a lot about, you know, I know a little about lots of things, but I don't really know what to do with that because it's just such a broad spectrum. But I always had something, you know, that I always wanted to try at least growing a little bit of my food, especially fruits. I just love, you know, papayas and bananas and that kind of stuff. I always, you know, be eating that at home and you know, started to play with those, you know, as you renting a property, and you might have a little veggie box on the side and you just throw a few seeds, not really know what's going to happen. But, you know, 3 months later, you might have a little bit of food. And
exactly.
So that's how it started in terms of, you know, looking into food systems perhaps. And, but I never, I mean, I still don't call myself a farmer. You know, I think coming from a city, you kind of look farmers as, oh, you know, farmers. I don't want to be a farmer. It's hard work, you know. I want to do something else, which is, you know, which is terrible because really, you know, to me, farming is kind of the most complex profession there is. It's just, you know, there is nothing as complex.
I have huge respect for farmers. I'm from Germany originally, and my stepbrother is an organic farmer in the biodynamic space. And, you know, I see him, wow, man, he's worked so much. It's insane all day long. Yeah. And every time I'm over there, I try to work with them at least 1 or 2 days just to, because I like doing it and, you know, connects me with my food a little more. But yeah, like you said, it is a really hard job.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, that's how I used to see it, as a hard job. But I think, you know, every job is a hard job. Sitting in front of a computer for 12 hours, I kind of go, man, that would be very hard.
Yeah, if you enjoy it, I mean.
Yeah, I think that is the question. You know, what do we enjoy doing it? But it's just, I mean, the way we've set up our human systems and the way most professions work, you know, it's pretty controlled. And you know tomorrow is going to be pretty similar to today, unless you receive, you know, a med call or kind of thing. But you know, with farming, you know, tomorrow is never the same as today. It's kind of, you have to be ready to wake up and go, all right, let's see what today will bring. And I find it, that's probably the hardest part of my experience is just that kind of that emotional task that you just have to show up and, you know, fix a pipe or, you know, prune a tree that just fell down or look at your veggie garden that yesterday was beautiful and the wallaby came overnight and now there's nothing to eat. And just dealing with those kind of processes, I find it the most challenging and something that we don't really experience, I think, in modern society these days. It's pretty, you know, everything is pretty regulated and, you know, you do this and you do that and that will happen. So it's, yeah, much respect for farmers. But also in saying that, I think we've lost, not a real loss, but farming has changed as well. In a sense that, you know, the demands, economic demands or whatever demands, you know, societal demands, farming has become much more recipe-based as well.
Especially the conventional farming, right? I mean, a lot of these big monoculture crop fields here, they have tractors and machines that aren't even driven by humans anymore. And I was just reading some food news yesterday where they were talking about like that the next 10 years is going to be all innovations and robots driving through muddy fields and like, you know, doing all the jobs of the humans. And the way they described it, I'm like, that does not sound like a good field, like a healthy field at all. Like, yeah. It does just doesn't sound good to me at all. But I know in your blog, so you said in your blog, once you did your master's in environmental planning, you quickly kind of realized that nature wasn't being considered in the bigger decision-making process. What do you mean by that? And does that kind of point to a broken system?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's quite interesting how basically, I mean, what I observed trying to work with council in my PhD is that, you know, the natural realm is only taken into consideration once everything else is at peace. It's kind of pretty much is the first thing that gets dropped as soon as there is any disturbance in the system. So basically, the whole, you know, what I understood, the whole planning of cities is like, all right, we want to have this building in this location. So that decision is made already. And then comes the thinking, all right, how can we make it more environmentally friendly? Where is then going, you know, and addressing, okay, you know, we have this population problem. We need more buildings, fair enough. Where are we going to put it that will cause, you know, the least amount of impact or will, you know, have infrastructure or whatever already in place? So it's just the reverse. And that's happening everywhere where the economy comes first. And then we go, okay, let's make this now a little bit more environmentally friendly. Otherwise, you know, our marketing going to suffer. So that's what I mean by that, is that nature is only considered once the decision has been made. And okay, all right, so the building is going to go there. The architecture plant is it's all planned and approved. And, you know, everybody got their fees. So, okay, so now let's look which trees we're going to plant in the boundaries, just so it kind of looks inviting. And it's everything very human-centered. So we're going to put this tree because they'll have some shade and, you know, the root is not too aggressive. They're going to damage our buildings. And there is a whole disconnection of the existing fauna, the existing flora, the existing processes. We're very quick to just jump on an excavator and start moving earth that has been, you know that soil has been there for God knows how long, with many processes that happen, and we're just quick to just go and remove it without even understanding what's the feedback of that. And then all we do is concrete and drain and do this to try and then ameliorate the problem we've created. And that's throughout the planning schemes. It's throughout human thinking, I believe, whereas our necessities come first, and then everything else needs to be accommodated to, and it becomes this kind of mismatch. So that's what I kind of found doing the planning there. And it's called environmental planning, but there is nothing but, you know, environmental planning. There is a few environmental legislation, but at the end of the day, if you can prove that your building is going to be economically viable and it's going to generate income and blah, 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 they go, oh, you know, this koala population, I'm sure there is some other koala somewhere. So, you know, there is a legislation, but you can always argue against it. And unless there is immense public, you know, outrage and then nobody will do anything to stop it. And people are just so busy to even pay attention that a new building is coming up and they are decimating some kind of koala population. So there is a whole disconnection for sure.
I do think that, yeah, and that's exactly that disconnection I see as well. And that's one of the things I'm trying to heal with the podcast, or at least help, you know, start conversations around this stuff. And I do see a trend toward people wanting better food, though, caring about where it's coming from, you know, and kind of requesting that from their farmers too, in the future. Now, the system in general will have to change for that to happen. But so once you realized that, you kind of decided to switch to more the permaculture approach, right?
Yeah, look, I've done my permaculture training in 2005 when I actually went back to Brazil for that year and a half trying to, you know, find myself again. And I really fell in love with permaculture and the way it was, you know, bringing those concepts together and trying to design more with nature as, you know, ecology as the leader rather than human as the leader. And we with our intelligence and skills and technology and tools, we can then, you know, build around it. So I really like that idea. But permaculture for me was also something that was almost too remote for my, you know, I could never really apply all those grand, you know, swales and compost buildings and natural building when you're just kind of living, you know, in a rental property on the Gold Coast or something like that. I found it hard to translate those grand principles into my reality. And I always felt that the food growing theory or concept within permaculture was a bit weak for me. Mm. It was a bit loose.
What do you mean by that?
There is some kind of structure in a sense that, you know, you can put these plants here and there. You know, there is a design to it, and you put closer plants together and closer to home and further apart, and that's fine. That makes sense. But to me, and that's where kind of syntropy comes and really, you know, and I think syntropy and permaculture, you know, it's kind of, it really makes permaculture stronger, I think. Because once you, yeah, okay, you, so you have all those plants and there is lots of, you know, plant gurus out there. They know all about the plants, but there's very few people putting them together and actually managing them in a way that it works. There is a lot of emphasis on the first few steps, which is know your plants, design it proper, and implement. And then it's basically walk away and nature will do it. And, you know, and nature does it, but nature does it in its own way, which is, you know, most often not really what we had envisioned. You know, unless we are there managing it and taking where we think it should go, you know, the wallaby will manage, or the cow will manage, or the ants will manage, or the rats you manage, and things just, I find, I mean, I'm sure there is great examples out there, but I find in general really hard to produce food consistently through those kind of design guidelines that stop there, that didn't follow through into, all right, now you design how you make it happen. But yeah, but the permaculture thinking, it's definitely with me. I think it definitely opened up my mind into trying to understand relationships better on how things work in the natural world and how, you know, feedback loops start to show up as well once you start digging things. Yeah, of course, there are things that I question with permaculture. I think the need for swales is a bit like, I'm not sure if the energy input and the energy output of swales, for example, is beneficial. And for me, water, it's something that needs to move, always be moving rather than be stagnant and forced down. So in my understanding, instead of spending all that diesel fuel into digging swales, why don't we just plant trees on those swales line? And, you know, especially trees like eucalyptus that have a very deep root, and that water will infiltrate, but it will infiltrate in a living way. Will infiltrate full of, you know, microbes and bacteria and organic matter and fungal and all this thing, which is then will hold that water rather than you just push it down and force it to stay where it doesn't want to do. And, you know, I don't know. I don't like forcing things. I like to try and work with the flows in a better, more gentle, more living way.
I love that. What you're doing is called syntropic farming, syntropic gardening. I guess it's related to permaculture. When did you first get exposed to that? And then maybe we can get into what it is, you know, kind of how it developed. That would be cool to hear.
Yep. Well, I'm just going to go back into the relationship between permaculture and syntropic farming. I mean, they are related in a conceptual framework, but in terms of how they came about, they're not really related in a sense that, you know, one is kind of came out of, you know, Brazil and Ernest, you know, Swiss, German kind of fella, that really studied productive system and regenerative system on a very practical, hands-on kind of how do you get that to work? Whereas the permaculture to me is about let's design it and hopefully the design will happen. So it's kind of, I mean, of course, now I think it's our job to bring the two together because I think there is lots of similarities, but they kind of emerged in different ways. That's how I kind of see it. So in terms of my journey with entropic farming, basically, I think I kind of knew a little bit on the work of Ernst Goetsch when I was in Brazil in 2005 doing those permaculture courses. And I kind of tried to do a course, but he was, you know, a few thousand K's away doing his thing. And
he's like, he's kind of the first one to start the whole movement, right? Or the whole idea of syntropic.
Yeah. So he's the founder, let's say, of, you know, I don't know if it's a movement, but he's the one that kind of put all that information together in a very neat way. Okay. Of course, he is not the one that created everything, but he's the one that observed and collected information and then put it in this syntropic umbrella, let's call it. And he's been doing it, you know, for ages. He's been 40 years down the track now. So we're kind of getting, you know, the cream of the cream of 20 years of, you know, very intense research and understanding of playing with, you know, many different plants in many different biomes and really working with that dynamic. So, I mean, it's very, very grateful to have somebody that has done a lot of work into bringing those concepts together in such a neat way. But in the beginning, it was chaotic. You know, I think in 2005, you know, 10, 15 years ago, it wasn't as pretty and as neat and as organized the way of thinking and managing. It was a bit more seed bomb style, as far as I understand. You know, let's just throw all those plants together and see what happened. And I think as he kind of worked with the processes, he kind of manicured it or made it, you know, much more neat and things fell through. But I think the whole explosion of syntropic farming came about maybe in 2015 or early 16 or something like that, when the Life in Syntropy movie came out.
I watched that. That's a great one. For anyone listening, definitely check that out on YouTube, Life in Syntropy.
Syntropy, yeah. So it was great work by Felipe Pazzini and Diana Andrade, who's, you know, spent a lot of time with Ernest and pulled a lot of their own resources to make it happen. And they made it, you know, an awesome, you know, very inspirational film. And I think when I saw it, there was another friend that saw it and go, okay, let's do it. I think that's a little bit what I was kind of looking for. Cause I had, at that time I had a small house in a little town called Ocean Shores, and my front garden was just like 200 different trees in 300 square meters that I just planted them without any knowledge of what I'm just going to plant and see what happens. So I was kind of doing syntropy, but without any guidance.
That's the mindset more people should have, that kind of mindset.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when that came about, we kind of looked and then we started to, you know, connect a few dots. That was probably early 2016, I think, when I watched it. And then by mid-2016, I was in Brazil and did one course there at Juan's place, which is called Sítio Semente, who is one of the guys that feature pretty heavily in the Life in Syntropy movie. And then came back and just Scott Hall and myself got together. I mean, we've been working together for a few years. I met him as I was doing my PhD, and we just, you know, did everything we could to make it happen, and, you know, made a million mistakes, spent way too much money. And then I came back to Brazil another three times, I think, in 1 year. And basically, I've tried to learn from everybody. I basically, you know, I've done about 10 courses, went into Ernest's place and Hicke's place and everywhere in Brazil, and forged a really nice relationship with Patricia Vaz, who's one of the, you know, one of my mentors, and who spent a lot of time with Ernest in the first, you know, 30 years, just following Ernest and helping Ernest and developing those series with Ernest as well. So I've been very grateful to be able to have, you know, that opportunity to go back to Brazil and really be able to engage with, you know, people that are doing it for 20, 25 years, 30 years, and be able to, you know, ask the questions to them and say, oh, what about that? What about this? And finally be able to, you know, have a more holistic picture on how things work and really go out there and see. Because I think it's very powerful. I think I remember going to that first course, and you start to be presented without that new nomenclature, you know, placenta this and that, and you're kind of going, okay, well, right. But just when you look and you see that, you know, I think it was only a 10-year-old kind of system, and, you know, something just shifted. You know, you see the eucalyptus and the mangoes and the bananas and the whatever, all kind of organized and producing and working together. Then you go, oh, look, it doesn't really matter the nomenclature. You know, that's what I want to do. I don't care how you call it. You know, let's do that stuff. Because you could see that the whole neighboring properties around this place was just like a semi-desert, pretty much. There was, you know, no green. And you can see that footage very clear in the life in sequence.
Yeah.
And then you go to his place and it's just like, you know, 5, 6, 7 meter tall canopy in full production. And you go like, oh, wow. Okay. There is a way out of that mess.
Yeah, that's powerful. When I saw that in that documentary, like literally basically a desert, a soil, like yeah. just degraded soil all over. And then this little like oasis in the middle of them just growing amazingly healthy plants from what it looked like. So yeah, wow, I love that. And let's talk about what it really is, syntropic farming gardening. Maybe we can start, you know, in your blog, you kind of took people through how the name kind of developed. I thought that was really interesting. Maybe we can start with that, kind of how it evolved and then, you know, what it really means.
Yep. Oh, look, yeah, I think that blog, what I try to bring is that, I mean, to me, what syntropic farming is, basically it's a different way, similar to permaculture in that sense, it's a different way of relating to the natural world. And I think it's what I like about that kind of history of how it kind of started to get developed. It was, you know, basically Ernest used to work with, I think, plant genetics, you know, kind of GM. and he kind of one day go, you know, why are we trying to, you know, modify plants to suit our environment or the mess we've created? Why don't we start to work with plants in their natural power and then change the environment in that way? So he just kind of flipped the coin, which I think it was, you know, such a powerful insight, you know, and that's, I think, something that we have to start doing is changing our mindset of, rather than just making our technologies more sustainable, is why don't we start walking the other direction and just see where that will take us. So I think that was great. And so he started to then looking in forests and, you know, how can we mimic that forest dynamics that, you know, forests don't need fertilizers, forests don't need watering, and they're highly productive. So how can we use that functionality or that systemic, that process into, you know, a system that could also feed us with, and that got inspired as well by many indigenous cultures throughout the world who were doing that. But to me, the great difference is that, you know, those indigenous cultures were almost doing it on an instinctual level. You know, they just did it because they did it. That's how you do it. Whereas we now perhaps have a more, you know, evolved, inverted commas, kind of consciousness with our technology that we just don't do it because we do it. Now we have to do it because we do it. You know, there is a whole meaning and of, you know, how we understand relationships. And so he started working with forests and forest dynamics and then trying to understand, you know, how they move, and it becomes so successional. So, okay, so there is a whole time frame that moves, especially when you observe that there is, you know, there is a forest and maybe a, you know, a tornado or a hurricane come through and creates a devastation, a big clearing. And there is a whole transitional stage from those very short life cycle plants that starts to come and then longer one and then longer one and then longer one. So there is that clear time frame that moves into recovering to a full forest again. And forests, you know, are something that is, it's always moving. We have that picture that forest is just static, but forest is just a mosaic of clearings that just keep happening with different processes. So there is that whole time scale that then came into the equation. And I think then the next thing that he started to focus is that, hey, wait a bit. So we have all those plants moving in time, but there is all those layers as well of plants fitting in space. And then he started to observe what we call, you know, stratifications, each plant having a different strata depending on how much light they require.
So that's stratification, you know, meaning that plants like to hang out at different levels of the forest, right? Some plants.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that has to do with how much light they need. So some plants, you know, which we call the emergent plants, they need to be out of the forest. So basically, they just have a little head. It's like our head popping out of the forest, which basically is, you know, I need sun full time. And that is, you know, your corn and your eucalypt. They play the same function in different time scales. And then you have your high strata, which your plants, you know, like your shoulders, where you're getting sun most of the time, but every now and then you get a little bit of shade, shadow from your head. And then you have your mid strata, which is your lower body, which gets, you know, maybe only morning, so, you know, morning and afternoon sun. And your lower strata, which is your feet, which is usually mostly in depot light kind of thing, let's call it. So he started to observe that there was this kind of spatial organization as well. And then he started to play with that, you know, okay, so let's move in time and space. But I think what the big thing that Ennis then observed, which, you know, he calls the cat's jump, which is kind of, you know, what really made the cat go boom and go, okay, let's go to the next level, is when he started to observe the production. I think it was, I don't know if it was in his property or in someone else's property, how much the cacao plants cropped after, you know, I think it was a little tornado or something, a cyclone passed through and really pruned things heavily. Everything just exploded in growth and production. So then, you know, what became clear is that, you know, for us to produce, we need to manage. We need to create that disturbance, because otherwise things just get old and tensioned. Whereas when you prune, or, you know, things just revitalize and becomes new, young again. You know, it just keeps coming young again. So that was, I think, to me, this is the defining factor of syntropic farming, is how can we add movement to something that is moves very slowly. So nature, you know, in a forest regrowth, you know, in our time scale, I mean, in geological scale, it moves incredibly fast. But in our, you know, 67-year-old, you know, scale of time, they move incredibly slow. But we can speed that up if we start to participate in the process. And by speeding that up, then we allow regeneration and production to happen, you know, much more powerfully, rather than waiting for things to just go and one plant that got old to die for the other one to come. We just come and prune, bringing down, organize, that one just keeps coming. And so you try to then, and that is the art of syntropic farming, is how you put out those layers in time and space that you can have this constant management, you know, from day 30 to year 35, that you just keep managing and you keep adding that motion into it. And that to me is then the beauty of, and you know, what I think syntropic farming is different, is that it kind of actually found a meaningful activity for human beings. It kind of almost found our function within the natural world, which is we can bring not only movement, but we can bring an organized movement. And organization is something that doesn't really happen in nature. Nature is quite chaotic. But once we bring our consciousness and our intelligence into it, and we start to organize things, and we start to put things and concentrate and dilute things, then nature can expand into areas that it can't by itself. And so can we. So I think it becomes this really beautiful, elegant, reciprocal interrelationship between humans and nature that still allows us to develop our technology and develop our culture and develop whatever, you know, our economic models, whatever. But we're doing that, you know, in a reciprocal manner in which is a win-win. So that to me is kind of the beauty of how this whole thing came together.
Wow. Yeah, no, that was really well said. So it's basically you're mimicking the way a forest grows, and you're adding the human element into there to speed things up. And it's all based on the five elements, or analog is the first, right? That would be like the, what's the analog part? That's like just the forest itself.
So the analog part is, because every forest is different. And so I think the analog is, how can we understand, you know, my forest, what's happening around me, and how can I bring those dynamics and those plants that are here showing me where they are into an organized system? So we kind of copying, mimicking what's happening there and organize it in a way that helps everybody.
And then from there, you go into the succession that you were talking about, which is basically like we're saying, and like looking at the how the plants pretty much rebound after some sort of natural disaster or some sort of disturbance. I'm going to share my screen quick because I pulled up a picture of this online just to make it, you know, a little bit easier for people to understand. And if you're listening, I'll just describe this quick. Can you see it? The screen?
Yep, I can.
This is from, I'm not sure if you know this guy, Roger Geitzen.
Yep.
Not sure how big your community is, so I figured you might know him. But natural succession, we're looking at an image basically of a forest that's, you know, from the first year where it's just basically, like you said, the plants that are covering the ground, grass or whatever, and it's slowly progressing linearly, you know, over the 30-year cycle here. And it's kind of just the graph is just kind of pointing out how that succession happens. But this is beautiful. I mean, this is awesome because how many farmers, really conventional farmers, take that into consideration, do you think? Is that?
Yeah, look, this is just a very, let's say, simplified agroforestry take into natural succession. But natural succession is happening since the earth became solidified, pretty much. So Ennis described three kind of large sections of natural successions. So basically you have a system of accumulation in the beginning. So that's, you know, when you have just a volcanic eruption and, you know, life starts to work and accumulate. And then you have the accumulation stage when things start to, you know, there's a bit more carbon available and a little bit of nitrogen available. And then there is the abundance stage in which, you know, it's abundant and there is plenty of water and plenty of phosphorus. And each of those bigger time frames then have the associated life forms with them. So this one is a very just specific, you know, 0 to 30 years kind of description so people can understand how life moves. But that's happening everywhere, anywhere across the planet, under the sea, there is always succession. So succession is basically the movement in time and space. And from the beginning of times, the earth is moving in both time and space. So that's happening everywhere.
Well, even so, I'm a forager. I'm pretty big into wild food, you know, looking for plants and mushrooms and also hunting, fishing and whatnot. But for example, morel mushrooms, there are a lot of mushrooms actually, even plants too. They love it. You know, if I know that a prairie was burned or a patch of woods was burned recently by the our Department of Natural Resources here, you know, I'll be going there to look for morels during morel season because they love that kind of stuff. So, I mean, that's another way to look at succession too, even though if you're a forager. And would you say that this makes this kind of farming much more predictable?
Predictable?
Predictable. Well, as in,
look,
I feel like if we didn't understand succession or even stratification, then you wouldn't really be able to understand the system in a way, you know?
Yes. So I think, I mean, predictable, it's a hard word. Because to predict, I think it means that it's almost to forecast what's going to happen. And if there is one thing that I've learned is when you're dealing with living processes, you know, things get a bit unpredictable. Things just react. Because we are free to go and do whatever we want. We can bring a bulldozer here and we can excavate there and we can chainsaw. But then there is the reply from nature on refining the equilibrium. And that can be, I think, quite unpredictable on how this will happen. So I think the knowledge of natural succession is kind of, it's basically you start to elaborate on a language, on a communication framework that you can, okay, try to think how things are moving, and then you try to put it in a let's say a logical, rational, economical, regenerative order. And then the most important thing is that you then continue the dialogue. And then you start to see where things are moving towards. Because I think, because then if you continue the process, then it's unlikely that something will just go, oh, hello, I'm a banana.
Yeah.
You know? Whereas if you do the I'll plant and I'll come back in 2 years, then I think a lot of unpredictable things would have happened. So I think that the being predictable or not is how much you participate in the process. And the natural succession is just, you know, that's how things work. Kind of full stop. It's a law. It's not a law that all you have to do. It's just how it is. It's life that just keeps moving through life and death cycles. And, you know, once things are alive, you know, it kind of, you know, syntropy means to converge, to complexify. So one life form comes and complexifies and then it dies. But once it dies, it left a material that is a little bit more complex. And then something else then picks that up and complexifies it again. And then once it dies, it's a little bit more complex. So through many repetitional cycles or iterational cycles, you know, life gets more and more complex. So it starts, you know, in the beginning where all you have is rocks and you have a little bit of lichen that comes in. And so that lichen dissolves a little bit of the rock and accumulates. And then something else that's a little bit higher comes and gets that accumulation and brings into a little higher and then a little higher and then a little higher. And then you start to have, you know, maybe some ferns and some small grasses and da, 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 and then a little shrub, and then shrub works. And then you can have little trees. And then, you know, after millennia, in a very many little successional cycles, then you get into, you know, a rainforest or a very, you know, rich savanna that is feeding elephants and giraffes and, you know, all those big, large mammals that can't live in the rock. You know, they require those systems that have a lot of phosphorus available, that have a lot of water available and that kind of stuff. So it's lots of little successional stages. And that's what we try to do with syntropic farming, is try to understand where your land is. So where, you know, how much life there is in your land, and how can you then organize it and move it through successional stages, let's say as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not only about time and quantity, it's a lot about quality as well. And so the quicker you can go through those successional stages, the sooner you get into a system that can feed large animals like us. So we have to understand that the food that we eat does not come from the desert. Does not come from, you know, the beach. It comes from very rich, alive ecosystems. So we have to try and mimic those ecosystems that so we can produce our food. But unfortunately or fortunately, what we have here with our fertilizers, it's a system that pretends that you are able to convince the plant that that plant is living in a very life-giving ecosystem because there is so much nutrient and so much water available. But as soon as you stop that, the plant go, excuse me, but that wasn't really the place I was meant to grow in. And, you know, pests and diseases and all those things show up.
Well, and also the issue with fertilizers, right, is that don't the plants not root as deeply because they don't have to go looking for water and nutrients as much? I think I've heard that before.
Yeah, look, I'm sure that happens. But the thing is that we've taken the plant, put it into a laboratory, and observed what nutrients it suck up. And it sucks up lots of nitrogen, you know, the NPK, you know, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Oh, great. So plants need those three to live. And we give that. But by giving those three macronutrients, all we are doing is making the plant pump more water. So basically, we're only enforcing the water cycle within the plant. So the plant grows big and green, but it's full of nothing. And you see, you know, you go in the supermarket and you buy the lettuce, you know, 2 days later, it's gone. You know, whereas if you go, you know, organic or regenerative, you know, that lettuce will last in your fridge for 2 weeks, easy, because it's full of life within. So once we put a lot of fertilizer yes, the roots won't go too far because there is nothing else to go. So they're just going to sit where the fertilizer are. But we also then stop the interrelationship between plants and the microfauna and the fungal activities. And that is where life resides.
And
so
that,
basically,
that,
yeah, you go.
That is the stratification part of the whole syntropic farming concept, right? Is basically how can we, so succession is how can we move these plants through time, but stratification is how can we have them work together in a way where everyone kind of benefits. Kind of how it works?
Yeah, so succession has two variables. The variable number one is time, so plants moving in time. Variable number two is space, so plants being organized in space. So that's the stratification part. So how can we organize our agroforestry systems in a way that move in time? So we go from corn to, let's harvest African mahogany or, pecan nuts, and let's go into space, from those plants that stay on the bottom, like your sweet potatoes or maybe your blueberries that are low strata, and then your mangoes or, things get higher. So we try to put all of those. So on the time frame, let's say from 0 to 3 months, which is a very short time scale, we still have the opportunity to find spaces. So we can have, sweet potato running. We can have the lettuce here. We can have a broccoli over there, and we can have, or a zucchini or a tomato, and we can have a corn. So we put that same, 90 days lifespan into four layers. But together with that, we planted the next one, which is, let's say, the 6 months to 1 year. So we can have taros and cassava, and then bananas and papayas, and then citrus and da-da-da, and da-da-da-da-da-da. So we plant all of those from 0 to 30 years. We planted together just as if it was a forest. And they just keep coming. And what we got to do is manage that. Because if we don't manage, then it goes.
And that's the first component, right? That's the human component that's super important in this as well. And that's the component that's absolutely kind of start lacking nowadays in conventional farming. Or it's soon to be, I just talked about robots in fields, maybe in the future it's totally gone. And now with all these, you're talking about a stratification, made me think of these vertical farms that are popping up everywhere. I don't know what your thoughts are on those. I think, my opinion is still, I'm still pretty open about them, but why not? We're doing these vertical farms because we're degrading the soil. Like, I feel like, there's not enough space, but why not just do it all in one and do this syntropic farming and regenerate soil as you go?
Yeah. Look, I think that is it's a technological fix, but we're not actually addressing the root cause of the problem. One of my jobs a few years ago, I was kind of in a hydroponic little farm just growing microgreens. And I learned a lot about, those hydroponic or aquaponic systems. And they are so energy intensive. The amount of energy that you require to pump water and filter water and bring in nutrients in, basically we're trying to grow plants in a very sterile environment. And that's, it needs to be sterile because the plants are so weak. And again, we're only favoring the water cycle. So, in my understanding, it's not going to take us very far because the amount of energy, if you have to spend 100 calories to get one calorie, we've got a problem because the 99 calories are coming from somewhere else that is becoming a desert. We're kind of mining things and processing things to then bring that nutrient into the high rise and it has to be in a salt base to be diluted into water to then be force fed into a plant, which looks great, but it's lifeless. To me, it's the analogy of, I can get a human being, put them in intensive care, so they are in an induced coma and they have all the nutrients, he's being fed intravenous and he looks beautiful, all rosy, healthy, but it's lifeless. So that human being is lifeless. It's almost useless. So that's what I think we are doing with those hydroponics systems is that, yes, it looks beautiful and green and shiny, but it's lifeless. And I think the more we start to look at quality, then the differences between a hydroponic lettuce or an organic lettuce or a regenerative lettuce, it becomes remarkable. Because when you start looking at the micronutrients and the phenols and the, you know, all those different aromatics, that that's what keep us alive, because we don't need, you know, the leaf is just something that is there. We need the force, we need the life force within those foods to keep us alive. You know, we gotta transcend a little bit more the material. You know, not everything in this world is matter. And we're not comparing, you know, a lettuce that is just matter with a lettuce that is full of living force will be very different in your diet. And I think by eating a lot of those lifeless food, you know, not only conventionally grown, but highly processed, it's actually killing us slowly. And the reflection to that is the cancers and all those diseases that is just in epidemic forms, because we're not supplying our bodies with living energies. We're just supplying it with dead minerals because we think that that's how things work. So I think the syntropic farming brings that other dimension, that there is more to our relationships with the natural world that is just matter and domination and competition and da-da-da-da-da. You know, there is many subtle dialogues and relationships that brings the quality, that brings, you know, the laughter, that brings the interesting, that brings the, you know, the nuances between people, you know, those kind of things that you can't put your finger on what it is, but that's what making a person interesting and a person boring. You know, they're the same. They're two people, but one has those interesting qualities and the other one is just dull and boring.
Yeah. So
it's the same with foods.
It would be really interesting to like see, you know, nutritional profile of something grown totally hydroponically and something syntropically. I don't know. Do you know if there's anything like that out there? I know they do it with wild plants. I've seen stuff where they're like compared to nutrients, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we can compare the nutrients, but that to me is not where the difference lies, because the nutrient is still very mechanical in a sense. Mm-hmm. You know, and once we start to move into the realm of qualities, then it becomes subjective. So to me, the only, you know, the key thing that I tell people to do is, you know, grow your own carrots or any veggie. It can be your broccoli, it can be your tomato. Grow any veggie you have grown. Take that one, go to your farmer's market and get an organic, let's say I've grown a carrot. Go to your farmer's market and get an organic carrot. Go to your supermarket and get a conventional carrot. Put the three in front of you. Have a bite of one, have a bite of the other, and have a bite of the other. And then you're going to understand what I'm talking about. So basically, the one from the supermarket is like cardboard. It's like, yeah, it's orange and looks like the other one. But, okay. You get the organic one. It's juicy and it's sweet. And you go, okay, this is a lot better. But then you get the one you've grown. And it's aromatic. You can smell the perfume. You put it in your mouth and it goes like, it's sweet, it's juicy, but there is a lot more. And unfortunately, that we don't have, our technology is not precise and fine enough to get that. And we have to then start to use our own bodies to find those qualities. And that is another problem, because people are just being fed, you know, too much McDonald's and they losing the perception. And they think that the carrots from the supermarket and the organic carrots taste the same. So I'll pay $1 a kilo rather than $3 a kilo. So it's a bit of a gray area, but to me, that's the only way. People need to get out there and start comparing. Once you move into the realm of life, that is not the realm of dead. A lot of our technology is about dead things. Once you move into the realm of life, you know, you don't have the concept of proof disappears. Basically, it becomes comparison. So this is better than that, and then this is based on this specific time frame. You know, so it's not that this is always better than that. It's not like today this is better than that. Tomorrow it will be different. Whereas, you know, our science tries to empirically prove that this is always better than that, and that only happens on the dead world. You know, on the very mineral. So that's the problem of going back into nutrients, mm-hmm. in which nutrients are dead, but your taste buds are very alive. And so I think that's where the difference needs to be, because then people go and say, no, these carrots, you know, are worth paying $5 because, you know, I feel absolutely amazing once I've eaten that. And that other one just makes me poop.
Yeah, no, I love that. Oh, man, it's so true that when you compare, you know, I mean, I would say the stereotypical example is always the tomato, you know, trying your own tomato compared to like the store-bought tomato that was green when they picked it and they artificially ripened it and whatnot. There's just no way it's going to taste the same. But talking about, you know, you were just talking about creating life. I mean, that is basically what syntropy means, right? Can you kind of go over the, you know, entropy versus syntropy and how they work together? And I have a little graph here from your blog too, that image you have.
Oh, yeah.
Because I thought that was a cool one just to share too.
Yeah. So, well, basically, I just finished a bit of a presentation, which I'm hoping to upload into YouTube today and share a bit, which goes a little bit into that conceptual framework of syntropic agriculture. And just to kind of present a little bit on what I mean. So I think first and foremost, we have to understand that we are part of this kind of macro organism that it has its own way of operating and has life as its instrument for realizing its goals. And so life is an activity. It has to be an activity. You know, there is not life as a noun. Life is a verb. We have to be moving. It's about living. So that's about that process. And so syntropy, as I understand, is a process that is, you know, I think it actually means a tendency to converge. So it's a tendency to bring things together, to accumulate. So that's what syntropy means, to organize. Whereas entropy is kind of on the other side of the polarity, which is about, you know, dissipation, is about disorganizing, is about simplifying. Yeah. So as you can see in the screen there, I'm just trying to really simplify that on the right side of the screen here, you have syntropy going through the leaf. So basically the sun, which is an entropic being, is releasing, is dissipating energy. Yeah. So that sun is then hits the leaf, and the leaf through a process of life, syntropy only happens through life. And that's something that is very, very important. So through this living process, the sunlight comes in, gets combined with CO2 and water and creates matter. Yeah. And so over time it creates wood. So that is a process of complexification. Yeah. So we went from some gas and a bit of warmth into matter. So that was done. So it was complexified. And I think everybody will understand that we complexify that. We create a higher form. We organize that in a different way. But the beauty is that this is done through cooling. And that's very important. It's done through a cooling process, because a lot of our technology, not a lot, everything generates heat. Yeah. So once you go through that other side, then you get that log and you burn that log. So now you're moving towards that other side of the equation where you're starting to now dissipate the energy that was once complexified by the leaf. And so as you do that, then you release CO2 again, you release water again, and you generate heat. So that's more or less, and then again, the plant comes again and gets that warmth and get that CO2 and that water that got released and blah, 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 and the cycle kind of continues. I mean, that's a very simplified, and fire is a very destructive kind of entropic process that go back into you know, the very beginning, go back into the gaseous form, and that's not where we want to go. But what we have to understand is that syntropy and entropy are both complementary forces, you know, and we have a tendency, I think, in our human minds to sit in one side of the polarity. They go, okay, no, syntropy is the way to go. It's all about, you know, growing and complexifying. But we have to understand that for syntropy to exist, entropy has to exist too. So the sun is entropic the earth is syntropic, and together they create life that keeps flowing back and forth. And that's where, you know, the beauty of that human interaction is that we have something that got complexified, you know, into a tree, and then we cut it down, we organize it into the soil, and by organizing them, then we make sure that it's warm, that is wet, that it's full of, you know, life-giving properties. And so now, if you look at entropy as like a decaying process, so now that starts to get decayed, and it turns into life again through the next plant. But, you know, but you went into a cycle, into you know, a plant complexified something to its maximum potential that plant can do. And then it's time for that plant to move on because life moved on. And so it decays. But the next plant that comes along, because now this material is able to feed on the ground higher forms of life, you know, fungal. In the beginning, it's all bacteria, but now you can have fungals and different types of fungal activities. So that complexified matter now, it's operating at a higher level. And so now we are able to have a higher level plant that then takes this higher level material and complexifies it again. And that process just keeps going in that kind of dialogue between inspiration, syntropy, respiration, entropy, you know, or syntropy growth, entropy decay. And as you do, you know, we need death to have life. It's part of, you know, there's no way. Imagine if every life form that ever existed was still walking around. It would be a big mess. So we need death. And that is something that syntropy also works with human beings, that we have this fear of death. But, you know, with syntropic systems, you have to kill. You know, killing is not the problem. Cutting the tree is not the problem. The problem is when you don't plant, then it's become a problem, because then it becomes just going through that decaying cycle. So you need to plant so that then the decay gets revitalized into a higher form of life. And so that process is the key, in my understanding, in syntropic or any regenerative type of agriculture, is that we speed up that movement between inspiration, respiration, or growth and decay, or syntropy and entropy, whatever side of the polarity you are in, they need to be interacting. If you just sit here, if you only are breathing in, man, you're going to have a problem. If you are only breathing out, you're going to have a problem too. You know, so our economic system, it's all about only breathing in. And look where we are. You know, we are hitting a problem that we can't breathe in anymore. And, you know, and our industrial revolution is all about breathing out. And we're not, you know, we have problems as well. So we need to breathe in and we need to breathe out. And the more we can bring a rhythm into that, you know, and that is that dialogue of natural succession and stratification, the more we can make that movement kind of silence and slow and just kind of with no tensions, then the better things get. And things move much more smoothly without too much unpredictability.
Well,
that was clear.
Yeah, no, that was great. And I mean, you know, me as a hunter and forager, even I can definitely relate to that. I think once you work with nature in a give and take kind of scenario, you start to realize that this is how it just works. Like, yeah. You know, even hunting, I mean, some people would say, you know, you said killing is a part of this syntropic farming, but, you know, some people would, like vegan people eat a vegan diet, for example, would say, you know, you're not, that's okay because you're not harming, right, sentient beings. But even in hunting, there needs to be a give and take like that. You know, if you just let those populations of animals go crazy and there's no predators, then they're going to damage, they're going to cause more entropy in some way. But, you know, you just need that system to really work together. And that's why I love this how you guys are doing it in syntropic farming. And also in this whole syntropy part that you were saying, I mean, you're basically just creating plant, right? Creating growth, more and more growth. And it's also, this is how carbon gets sequestered out of the atmosphere, right?
Yeah.
Which is huge. I mean, we're trying to figure out how to face climate change and all that, but I don't think there's enough talk about how we can use farming methods to really sequester carbon out of the atmosphere and put it back into the plants by creating that plant matter and even the soil. Like, yeah. And I think syntropic farming, I mean, that's all you're doing, right? I mean, it's a byproduct of this way of farming is you're taking carbon out of the atmosphere like that. Obviously, you got to put some back too, but I mean, that's how the earth has been doing it forever.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at some, I think there has been a little bit of research on some of the older farms in Brazil, and you know, the amount of carbon they're sequestering is, you know, it's way better than any forestry system because you have this movement. And we have to understand that, you know, the best way to sequester carbon is through life. You know, it's in living bodies. You know, that's how we sequester things. That's how nature has done for, you know, God knows how many years. You know, that's how it came down into having petroleum. It was for plants accumulating carbon in their own bodies and then going through whatever geological time pressures and whatever and turning into that. So again, I come back to that point in which we have to change our mindset. You know, we think that everything is dead, but everything is alive, and we have to start to work with living forces. You know, kind of sequestering carbon by, you know, pumping it into the middle of the earth is not the solution. You know, turning into biochar, it's not the solution either. You know, why don't we just work with life? Because life is the principle. You know, life is what it's governing the system. So let's work with life and let life sort it out. You know, we have to stop killing things and expect it to solve the problem. So that's the thing. I think we've created, you know, through our evolution of consciousness, which is, you know, it was necessary. You kind of evolved from, you know, being tribal clans and kind of just doing things by instinct. And now the intellect has developed and we have separated and become more individualized. Yes, I think it's beautiful. But now we have to go continue the loop. And instead of, you know, everybody was one together, now we have to be everybody as an individual coming together from our freedom of choice. But we still have to work with living processes. You know, we still have to make our own choices based on life, based on what is the overall governing legislation of, you know, the planet and the cosmos. And I don't know how far you want to go, the galaxy or whatever. You know, things are moving. Life is moving. So we got to work with life. We have to put carbon in living beings. And the more we do that, then the better for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. That's so spot on. And that's how this kind of farming is so sustainable, you know, because you are regenerating at the same time. So,
yeah,
you know, the soil, this is something I'm really trying to explore more. How should people understand the soil and, like, how important is it in the syntropic system?
Yeah. Look, I think soil is everything. But it doesn't mean that you have to start with a big fat soil, you know. But soil is, I mean, not soil, but to me, humus is where life is. So a humic substance is that substance that it's kind of dead and alive. It's kind of mediating between those two.
Well, it's quite, it's
worth, and I think, you know, the whole,
it's kind of where syntropy meets that entropy, right? Like, right,
absolutely,
when we go back to entropy.
Absolutely. It's where the transition is happening. And I think that's why, you know, up to the Green Revolution, composting was so valuable. Because basically we are getting this plant matter, composting, turning into humic substances and putting it back. So, you know, so that's why we have to go back to. But I think what, you know, syntropic farming does, because making compost, in my understanding, in my practice, it's so labor intensive. Gathering all those things, coming into a pile and changing and mixing and da-da-da and watering is very labor intensive. I think what syntropic does by just organizing, creating layers on top of layers on top of layers on top of layers in the soil with more, as time goes on and more plants are, you know, fulfill the cycles, then that humic substance stays in there. And, you know, it's you don't have to be, you know, double handling anything, basically. But it's not, and that's something that it needs to be clear, it's not chop and drop. It's chop and organize.
So because that's
organization. No, yeah, you go.
Well, that's where you basically come in as the human component, and you prune these trees, you cut the branches, and then you organize. So how do you organize them? You know, how does that all work?
Yeah. So basically, organization is the key to making sure that what was cut will degrade and decay, is a better word, in the best possible way. So basically what we want to do is keep the woody material as close to the soil as possible. So wood hours on the soil. If that happens, then we have worms, you know, create a beautiful environment. And then the more leafy branch material comes on top and covers it. Because we want to have this solid wood wet. The more wet it is, then the quicker, you know, go into a tropical rainforest or in any rainforest, and you have these massive trees, and you step on them and they just punch. That's what we try to create. But if you chop and drop and you have a branch standing up, forget it. You know, that's just going to sit there and oxidize. And all you're going to be doing is attracting termites.
Yeah.
So it's very important. Nothing sticks up. Everything sticks to the ground. And then we have the biggest stuff on the ground followed by finest stuff. So then you're trying to keep the biggest stuff as moist as possible. So it's very important to organize in that way. And then, of course, as you prune, you organize the canopy into those different layers, and you remove things that are, you know, old or from a previous successional cycle or da 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 da. So it's all about management and organization, because that's our beauty. That's a gift that we have that no other creature in this planet has. So that's how we can help nature to continue its evolution, and as it helps us.
It's a beautiful way of thinking about it. Like, we're using our critical thinking, you know, as species in nature to help it along, and everyone benefits. That's just awesome. And yeah, I can see how, you know, you said in your blog that syntropic farming is more knowledge-based rather than input-based. And that, yes. I mean, that makes so much sense to me now just after talking to you. But yeah, you just need to really, it seems like you guys just really understand your environment. You know, you need to for this to work. And by input based, you obviously meant like fertilizers and pesticides, right? That a lot of conventional farmers are using. Are you still using that kind of stuff? What's your philosophy on maybe, you know, taking some of the synthetically made human component and adding it to the nature?
Yep.
Or to the system?
Look, I don't have anything against those things in principle. You know, my problem is when their use becomes an addiction, where, you know, every time you just put it more and more and more, and you're always walking backwards. So there is no rule in syntropic farming that you have to be organic and this is forbidden, and, you know, no. So again, we go back into our main framework, and what we want to do is increase life. It's to have more life. And we have to take ourselves as human beings, and that's very important, that I think I try to bring that into that text that I've written, is that a human being is also part of the equation. And the human being has to survive. So you know, if let's say, for example, you are a conventional farmer and you wanna, you know, move towards a syntropic system. But, you know, up to this day, you were heavily chemical, you know, and you're going to go, oh, no, you can't use chemicals. Then we're going to have a problem, right? So to me, the idea is, okay, how can we start to shift that dependence, that addiction that you have in chemicals to a system that it becomes more organized, more self-sustaining, so more alive? So, you know, it might be that, you know, all you do is grow, you know, let's say bananas, full of chemicals, you know, let's try to work, you know, with some living processes, you know, let's see what's happening with the water cycle. Let's see what happened with the nutrient cycle. Let's see what happened with the dynamics of the communities. You know, maybe we plant, you know, a couple of eucalyptus or some tall trees, a bit of shade, or just something that we can cut and mulch the soil, and start a process of transition that we then start to bring life back into the soil. And maybe instead of putting urea on, which is kind of really highly dilutable nitrogen, maybe we put a little bit of a chicken poo. Let's see how that goes. You know, maybe chicken poo and some, you know, pigeon pea chopped on top will do the job. And maybe we do this, and maybe, you know, whatever, you start to make those transitional actions, that the goal is that in whatever X years, which is not fixed because everything is moving, but we are moving in that direction of more resilience, more life, rather than moving in that direction, which is, I need more fertilizer, I need more debts, I need more this, and my production is going down. Mm. So it's kind of, how can we start to just, we don't need to go from here to there, but how can you start to make the loop that, you know, the direction of movement is towards more life?
Oh, yeah. So that's great.
And that's very context specific. So, I'm in a highly degraded soil, you know, super steep, west facing. We had the driest year on record last year, you know, hell kind of thing, in a sense, really hard to work with. And I still need to grow my food. So yes, I put a little bit of, you know, I don't put urea, but I put a little of, you know, chicken pellets and a little bit of maybe some rock phosphate, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, because the plant that I need to eat needs that abundance of life. And if I don't have it, then I have to bring from somewhere else. But at the same time that I planted, you know, my broccoli or my lettuce or whatever else, I also planted my eucalypts and some bananas. Some of them went well, some didn't, and I planted some pigeon peas and da-da-da. So now I start to work with that process. And hopefully next time, instead of putting, let's say, a kilo per meter, I put 900 grams. And next time, 700 grams. And next time, 300 grams. And next time, no more. Or something like that. So it's, you know, and that is something that is very important, because people think that syntropic farming now is now the silver bullet. Oh, no, you just put some eucalyptus and some bananas together and sweet. In 2 years, you know, life is pumping. And look, it's not like that. You know, this is not a religion. This is not a cult. This is not a myth. There is a lot of work. There is a lot of processes. There is a lot of knowledge that comes into it. There's a lot of human participation into it to drive it. But you don't go from 0 to 100. You know, this is not a Ferrari that you go from 0 to 100 in 3 seconds. You know, you go from 0 to 1 in 3 seconds, beauty, and then 1 to 3. And hopefully you follow, you know, an exponential curve that you go 1 to 3, 3 to 9, 9 to 9, and then. But until you get into, there is a fair bit of work to be done.
Yeah.
It's not a miracle.
So it's almost like a shot of espresso to get your day started, and then you don't need it. And, you know, yes. Like, it's more of an aid. I like that. Because, you know, we usually think, like, fertilizer bad. But it's bad in a system where you're going to need more and more and more of it. But if you're just using it in a way to, like, help out, you know, wherever it needs to, so the system can work on it by itself or as much as it can without adding any synthetic fertilizer, then why not? Like, that's a great way to think about it. Yeah. What about, like, pests? Are you experiencing that all the time? Or have you found that once you put certain plants together and all that, that some of that decreases maybe even? Are you always gonna have the pests there? Is that just something? It's, you know, just part of nature again that we can't really control too bad.
Yeah, much. Look. Yeah, I mean, pests and disease are part of nature, and again, I think we have to go back into the bigger framework that we're dealing with living processes. And so, when we're dealing with living processes, part of the exercise is not to go and kill the pest, but it's try to understand, why are you here? So basically, we humans tend to go, it's your fault, it's his fault, I've done everything right, I planted this and I put that, who am I going to blame for me not getting it? And the reality is that pest and that disease is telling, hey, you know, this is what you have done that perhaps didn't quite work. So again, it's a different mindset of trying to work with those life forms and try to understand, why are they here? You know, are they here because, you know, like I just can't be able to grow eggplants. And I know eggplants are more Mediterranean and da, 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 but there's nothing can happen. I mean, I grow beautiful seedlings as big as I can on my greenhouse and they're beautiful, shiny. I put it on the ground and like 3 weeks later, it's just completely destroyed, devoured, da, da, da. It doesn't matter how much fertilizer or water. So, you know, this is what I try to see is like, okay, so those pests and disease are taking this plant out because that plant does not belong here. Yeah. So that plant, like every life form requires a niche. to survive. Yeah, human beings can't live in minus 40 degrees if they don't have, you know, central heating and all that kind of stuff. You know, they can't. So that plant, that eggplant plant, you know, for some reason there are things that it needs that it's not getting it. And so when it's not getting it, and that could be shade, could be water too much, not enough, boron, nutrient, I don't know. And I don't care what, you know, it's, there is so many variables that if I'm going to be looking, you know, who I'm going to blame, I'm going to have a problem. So it's basically, okay, so I learned my lesson. Maybe I'll grow a different variety of eggplant. You know, I'm looking now into, I'm going to grow a Thai variety, which is a more kind of humid kind of subtropical variety. See if that go, or I'll try this and I'll try that. So that to me is what the role of pests and disease are. They are telling you something that you are doing that is not quite working. And of course, I can go and get organic or chemical pesticide and pest everything. And I go, no, I'm going to get my eggplant no matter what. And I might, but what's in that eggplant? You know, it's probably something that is not worth eating anyway. So, you know, so again, I think one of the beautiful things of syntropic farming is that ecology is the leading factor. So ecology is there and you have to work with it. You know, if I'm going to, oh, I need to grow corn here and I'm going to grow corn no matter what, then the only way that I'm going to grow corn is if I have, you know, very good irrigation, if I'm pumping, you know, all those chemicals in terms of nutrients and pesticides and blah, 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 to grow the corn, because the ecosystem, the amount of life and dynamic movement is not there to support corn. I mean, corn is like highly, you know, it needs a lot of life, you know, a lot of life. So part of the art form of syntropic farming is understanding, okay, my land is here or is there or is there. And in that situation, I can grow this. And I can grow this by putting a bit of that. You know, because if I'm going to be forcing this plant to grow there, then I'm going backwards. You know, then it's going to be very frustrating. And then we go back into conventional agriculture where soil is basically a substrate. You know, there's nothing alive in there. It's just something that
it holds. You
know, hopefully will hold some nutrients. But basically, you got to play so often, apply so often, because it's all water-based. And it's almost we're doing hydroponics on a massive scale. That's well, what it is, basically.
And we're getting to the point where that soil can't hold water anymore. So that's why you got to keep watering it too, right? And that's how you get all the runoff too. It's fascinating. And I think that has something to do with the CO2 even in there, in the soil. I think, I'm pretty sure I read something about how like once CO2 gets into the soil, it can also hold more water or something like that. Yeah, I'll have to look into that more again. But
no, it's organic matter. Organic matter in the soil increases I think you'll disappear. I'm not sure if it's my internet or yours.
You're still there. You're still there.
All right, cool. Sorry. Yeah, so basically it's organic matter. I'm not really sure the factor, but it's something ridiculous. I think every 1% of organic matter that you are able to add to your soil, you know, you increase by a factor of, I don't know, 10 or whatever, how much water it can hold. It's unbelievable. And that's what we're trying to do with that chop and organize, is to bring more organic matter, because life itself to all these microfauna processes start to bring organic matter down. Or, you know, in 2 or 3 years, all that thing that you put it on top becomes soil. So the roots are coming up. So that's, yeah. I mean, life, we are in a planet that life is the governing force and life creates life. We only have free oxygen in the atmosphere because we have life, you know, that is constantly going through a process of inspiration and respiration. As soon as life goes away, you know, oxygen will bond with, you know, aluminum substance and iron substance and will be gone. And that's why there is no free available oxygen in Mars, because there is no life, you know. So we only have this beautiful planet because there is life, and we only have life because there is life, and life is the answer to every living question.
Yeah, and we're taking it away. Yeah, we're making land less lively with this current agriculture.
Yeah.
So what about, well, I mean, it sounds so, like, yeah.
The problem is not the agriculture. The problem is the thinking behind the agriculture. So we have to take responsibility. We have to change our thinking rather than change the agriculture. Because if we change our thinking, the agriculture will change naturally. But if we only change the agriculture, then all we're going to be doing is for more efficient process, robots, and they're probably just going to get worse because their thinking is the same. It's competition. It's let's kill. Let's do this. Let's just dig and blah, nuclear bombs. So it's the problem is in the human mind, not on the agriculture.
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, it's the change that has to come from the people, from the even the consumers, you know, people listening. Like, you have so much power with the demand. You know, if you demand the right foods, those companies are going to go there. I mean, we're seeing it in the whole low sugar diet, you know. People want low sugar foods now. And within the last 5 years, so many low sugar products are coming to the market. And those companies follow the trends. So if you're like demanding this kind of quality food that we've been talking about, you know, that might be a little bit more expensive, but a lot of the food you're buying right now is only super cheap because it's getting heavily subsidized in the first place. So that's something to think about too. Well, it sounds like syntropic farming can be pretty much done in every climate that has life, has plants, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there is a little bit of, I don't know if it's because of the name syntropic, and because most of the pictures have a banana in it,
yeah,
that there is that perception that syntropic is about the tropics only. But when you think natural succession, which is the main driver of syntropic farming, it's happening everywhere, you know, in the climate, in the arid zones, in the Mediterranean, under the ocean, you know, every piece in the earth is moving through succession. So, but what I do in the subtropics where I live will be different from what you might do in your temperate climate or what somebody else will do in the Mediterranean climate, blah, blah, blah. So that's why the analog concept is very important. So
yeah, that's
you have to understand what's happening there.
And the whole knowledge-based part of it. So how many syntropic farms are out there roughly? Do you think we have them in like every kind of climate around the world, or is it more focused on the, you know, your kind of climate?
Yeah, look, I think predominantly there is more examples of on the tropic and subtropic climates, because that's kind of coming out of Brazil and this is in Bahia, and you know, people that have been doing are more in that climate. But also because things grow really fast, you know. So like in 2 years, I mean, not in my case, but in 2 years, you can show a picture of a whole forest. You know, if you do it, you know, follow some of the principles proper, you go from you know, a degraded grassland into a forest in 2 years in those climates that are growing all year round. Whereas if you are, you know, in some parts of the US or whatever, that you have 3, 4, 5 months of snow, it's probably a little bit different. So that's important to understand that. But I think it's, you know, that there is more people out there. I'm not sure how things are going in the US. I don't hear much coming out of the US and Canada. I do hear a little bit coming out of Europe. Some people in Portugal, some people in France, and in Italy, which is more kind of Mediterranean climate as well, starting to put those systems into place. How many farms in terms of commercial farms? I don't think there is that many. From the simple fact that it takes time. You know, I can't go to your land and give you a recipe and you can just go and do it. It's basically, you have to create your recipe and keep adapting and changing it on a daily basis almost. And I don't think we have enough people that have 25 years experience that have managed, you know, let's say a 15-year-old mango orchard with pecans on top or whatever, that can actually provide such an in-depth consultation either. So I think, unfortunately, it's a bit of a slow process in terms of this, you know, I am a syntropic farm. But I think there is more and more smallholders kind of going, that makes sense. I would try maybe an acre of that or half an acre of this. And, you know, also on the larger scale, we do lack machinery for it. We do lack machinery that work with life. Again, you know, if you look at our agricultural machineries, they all came out of the wars. You know, so they are killing machines adapted for agriculture. So now we have to create living machines kind of thing where the impact on compaction and things are much slower. And we're doing things that sustain life and help life rather than kill things.
Well, that's the issue with the big tractors and all that, right? It's just damaging the soil again. It's just too much pressure under, too much weight, always just making that soil super dense. It can't hold any air and water again. And yeah, that's interesting though. So I guess the machine part needs to be figured out. Also, how do we get it to the people, right? Like you said, it's kind of a slow process.
Yeah.
Thankfully, there's younger people like you, you know, in it and doing it now. That's great to hear. And
I think there is a few, let's say, log jams for it to become fully commercial on a widespread. Well, one is machinery. That is a problem. Two is the mentality, and that's more important, the mentality of the farmer in coming back and working with those life processes, which is very different than what we've been doing. And then, as you said, the mentality of the customer that understand the differences, that we're not comparing apples and apples here. You know, one product that is fully alive and is doing good for not only for the economy, but for the human being behind it, for the community behind it, for the ecological community behind it. Whereas the other one is just being completely subsidized. You're not comparing it. So there is, I think, that supply and demand, that consumer consciousness is going to be difficult to change a bit, because food is, and I don't really get it, food is kind of the first thing in your budget that drops.
Yeah, I don't understand it either.
As soon as there is a crisis, you know, you go from eating vegetables to mac and cheese, but you still put premium petrol in your car. It's kind of... And you're still drinking premium beer, but so it's kind of that mental, you know, conscious effort that we're going to have to do it. And that's why, I mean, for me, where I'm applying in my life and what I want to work more and more is on that subsistence level, is, you know, with individuals and families and perhaps small communities to help them to start to engage with nature in a different way so they can grow their food that's going to be the best food for them. You know, you can't find your own grown food anywhere else, that you have that relationship, you know, from seed to table is very special, but also you start to change the thinking. And we have, I think, you got to work with individuals now, because now we have many individuals. We don't have a tribe anymore, that the leaders say, let's go to war. And everybody goes, let's go to war. Now you have a lot of individuals that are self-thinking. And I think we have to start working with individuals and then communities that are based on individuals as well, and hopefully start to change that paradigm into a living paradigm from something that we've been indoctrinated, that everything is competing out there and it's the survival of the fittest. And you got to be the fittest, because if you're not the fittest, you're going to die. Whereas, you know, the new way is like, no, you can be whoever you want to be. We value you for what you are and what you bring into this world. And I'll help you, you help me, and we help each other. And together we make the world better. So that's, I think, where we have to start to steer the curve towards. It's a long process, but the more individuals we have doing it, then the easier it becomes for the next one to do it.
Well, let's talk about that, because I asked on my social media, I asked people, you know, I told them I'd be talking to you, and I asked them, like, what do you want to hear? And most of the people said they want to know if they can use any syntropic techniques at home. Like, is this something people can do at home?
Yeah.
And maybe, maybe there's a way to, maybe you can walk us through like a little example of what a raised bed or something could look like.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, look, everything starts on, you have to cover your soil. Basically, that's to me is regen ag 101. You know, you have to have a good layer of mulch on top of your soil, because if you don't, then that is death straight away.
Well, what would mulch be for people, you know? Like, I mean, look, any
it can leaves? Be anything. It can be leaves, it can be grass clippings, it can be wood chip, it can be anything that is organic matter. You know, if you had lots of cardboard, shred them and put them on, you know, whatever. You need to put a roof on top of your soil. And you can do a very simple experiment. Go out on midday on a sunny day in the middle of summer and stand there for half an hour, you're going to understand what your microfauna is doing on a bare soil on the same condition. They are burning. They are frying. They are dying. So I think that's the first thing. Cover your soil with a thick layer, maybe 5 to 10 centimeters. What's that in inches? 2 to 4 inches. Mm-hmm. To make sure your life in the soil has a roof to live under. And then try to have your garden as full of greens, as full of plants, as much as possible. There is a few little, recipes or what plants you can put together on that really short life cycle. And then try to have them occupying as much of that garden bed as possible for as long as possible.
So
there'll be another thing. So you are able to connect. Yeah.
What are some common plants you would put together? Like, obviously depends on your climate, right? But you're also in your plots, you also have veggies underground, right? From what I was seeing, there's all your
yes.
lettuces and broccoli and all that, because those are all plants that people could use here too.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think a little veggie garden in the backyard, you're probably not going to be putting, a banana or an eucalyptus because, that's going to be the end of your veggies kind of thing. So you're always going to need a source of organic matter. So that's your soil that you're just going to keep building it. Yeah. And then you try to put your plants together. So let's say, again, working with, 90 days window. If that's what you want to go for, depends on your growing season or anything. So you can have something that is an emergent plant. So something like a corn or an okra can go in there. And then you can have something, so that's kind of summer plants. So on the lower level there, you can have perhaps a zucchini, a bit of a squash, or even a tomato climbing onto the corn or some kind of trellis. And then you can have a bit of a lettuce underneath. And you can even have some rocket and some radish right in the beginning because they're really quick. In 30 days, they're out of that. So it's kind of trying to play with that time. There is a really interesting book which people can go into the Syntropic Agriculture Community on Facebook. And in one of the main pages, there is a resource page that one guy put it together, which is really good. And there is a book called Agroforestry in the Woods, From Machetes to Tractors. It's a book written in Portuguese and been translated. And in the back of that book has, a list of plants and where they fit in that time and space. And then there is some really nice examples on how to put things together. Because you have to be playing with, the spaces of the emergent. You can't have, a full bed of corn and then a full bed of zucchini and then a full bed of lettuce all together. So you have to play a little bit with the quantities. So let's say the corn, which is an emergent, there will be only 20% compared to a monoculture. So let's say if a monoculture was 10 plants for a square meter, you might only be able to have, two plants per square meter. And so, in that book, I think it gets a bit complicated for me to explain here, but that book presents really nicely with some nice little tables that I think people can start to just play. And that's the most important is that, yes, entropic farming is knowledge-based, but it's real knowledge-based. It's not like you need to know the whole encyclopedia of botany to start. It's basically having an idea and going, I'm going to give this a go. And then I'll come back and see this work, this doesn't. All right, so my another go, I'll change this. And then my next one, I'll change it. And as you keep moving, you have a succession of thinking as well that happens that you start to understand it better. So I think that's, to me, I've started really big in the big to my kind of skills and access of land and whatever. And when you start too big and just moving too big and too quick, you miss the lessons. You miss the, so this doesn't quite work. I'm going to change it. So very important. I think the best advice I can give to people is small and often. One little bed, 1 meter a week, is a lot better than getting our friends together and planting a 15-meter bed.
Yeah.
Because every time you prepare your new bed, there's always, and I find that amazing. I've done kilometers of bed by hand, and every time my bed has something different. It might be the way that I use a tool, the way I position my body, how much fertilizer I put, what is the spacing between those plants. It's unbelievable that every time you do it. So if you do 15 1-meter beds, it's a lot better than one 15-meter bed.
Yeah, and I think people would be surprised how much you can get out of a small bed, especially if you're planting a variety of plants like that. Like something like a zucchini, you know, that, or like a squash, they just keep producing for that period like crazy. Like me and my stepbrother did it the first time, we didn't know what we were doing. You know, we just started with good soil. We made sure we had that. And, you know, watered them, obviously, when you're so, like, enough. But we were so surprised at how much food we got from our little plot of land. That's really what changed my thinking, like when I experienced that. But it's interesting, because I really think, you know, that's how we can decentralize this. If
yes.
More people do it at home, right? And it's not that difficult. It's not that hard. If you're doing this centropic way, that might take, it's probably going to take a little bit more time to get there. But I think in the long run, that's the way to do it for sure. You know, even for people at home. But just, you know, you don't need to do it centropically. You can just start with a normal bed too, garden bed, and just do what you can. But obviously, you know, keep this in mind. And yeah, you can, I mean, I'm sure you're, like you said, you just mentioned that Facebook community. For me, learning how to forage and hunting and just cooking wild foods, the Facebook has been a game changer. You know, just like those groups are amazing. You just ask questions and people give you their input, and it's that kind of community you were talking about earlier, you know, like give and take, and everyone benefits.
Yeah. I just want to say something that, you know, that you said that I just want to not correct, but point out, we have to be careful to say, oh, this is entropic and this is not syntropic.
Mm.
You know, I don't think there is such a sense, such a clear definition. To me, syntropic is in which direction are you moving? You know, because you can say, oh, the guy is, you know, putting fertilizer and then, oh, that's not syntropic. You know, it can be syntropic if it's moving in the right direction. So even at the home garden, just by mulching your soil, to me, that is syntropic.
Okay, yeah.
Because you're making life more livable. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's, you know, so even if you only have a 30 days window and you just put a radish and you mulch your soil, to me that is syntropic. And you make sure that next time your next radish crop will be a little bit better. And then your next one will be a little bit better. So I think that's, again, is the mentality is that syntropic is a never-ending positive interaction with nature. So if you start with best soil and now you're mulching, you are syntropic. You know, if you're monoculture and now you have one more plant, you are syntropic. If you are using 100 kilos of pesticides per year and now you're using 50 kilos, you are syntropic. You're moving in the right direction. So that's why we need to get more people not crucifying for what they're doing or not doing, but if they're moving in that other direction, let's make sure that they continue moving. Let's support them, that they continue to move there, because one day they will, you know, get out of pesticides, they will get out of fertilizer. That's what we all want to do. They will become resilient if we encourage them rather than judge them what they're doing. So let's everybody start as slow, you know, the roundabout. You just go slow in the roundabout and it feels like you're going the same way, but slowly you start to turn and all of a sudden you're going the opposite direction. That's all we need to do. Encourage the full roundabout turn. You know, don't take the first left or the come back into the same road you came in and get moving in the other direction. So syntropy is a direction. It's not a place. It's not a fact. It's a direction of movement. That's how I like to see it. Anyway, just to conclude, so syntropy is a direction of movement and everybody is welcome. You know, it doesn't matter what you do, what you think. Let's just walk together. Let's go the full roundabout and yeah, let's move it.
So you have the first syntropic like commercial farm, right, in Australia? Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, with Scott and I started the first Syntropic farm in Australia. I'm no longer there, so Scott is the one managing now for the last couple of years since I moved into our friend's property and I started this more. Because for me, I mean, I'm not a farmer. It's not where I want to act as a commercial farmer. So my interest, as I said before, is more on the individual, the educational, the changing consciousness and empowering individuals. But yeah, that was the first one we founded almost, I don't know, 5 years ago.
And now are you considering teaching this to people?
Yeah, look, I think finally I reached a level of understanding in both, you know, conceptual and experience as well, that I think I have something that I can share, that I can, I have now built, you know, grown a number of systems that I can start showing people. And give that factor like I felt the first time I saw it, which I really, you know, don't really understand what they're talking about, but you can see it and you go, okay, you know, I think that's the direction I want to move towards. So with that, I'm now for the first time started, we're going to run a couple of courses a year. I want to do one now in the Easter break and then one in the beginning of spring, in kind of October, November, maybe mid end of spring. Because these are my kind of key management times, and I really want people to manage. And that's something that it's contrary to the norm. Most people think that management is an advanced course. But to me, management has to be the basic course. Because if you don't know how to manage and now you know how to plant, then you kind of don't know what you're doing. So I do. You do need people to be confident, to get out there and chop leaves and kill plants and put things into order. So once they go back home, of course, you know, in the course, we're going to teach how to put those plants together. We're going to teach how to dig the soil and that kind of stuff. But we're not going to be doing just that. You know, a lot of the courses you go and you spend 3 or 4 days just digging and planting. And to me, you know, once you've planted 5 lettuces, you got it. You know, you don't need to plant 255 lettuces to get it. You know, after 5, 6, I think you switch to go and play. But the management side is where I think people need to have that encouragement to go out there and feel comfortable. And again, it's about your frame of mind on how you approach the plot. Even though, let's say you're going to go, all right, let's manage the castor oils or let's manage the pigeon peas. You know, every pigeon pea still needs to be treated as an individual. You don't just go and vroom and vroom and vroom and that's it. No, you go to that pigeon pea, you look what's above, you look what's below, what's happening. You cut this one in one way and the other one's going to be slightly different and da-da-da. So the task is the same, managing the pigeon pea, but the action is very individual. So again, you tell this to a robot, forget it, it's not going to happen really. So you need that human being to be confident to go there and to be confident that, hey, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to kill a plant that you didn't think you wanted to kill, or blah, blah, blah. You're going to forget to manage this. And that's part of the learning. That's what I want to start to provide people with the experience, because I find a lot of the courses, people go into the courses and they go like, oh, yes, Syntropic is great. And they go back home and they got nothing. They don't really know where to begin. But I'm hoping here they have they start to change how they relate to the natural world. So when they go back home, they start to see the world differently. Yeah. They start to see, okay, you know, just as you drive home, you actually look the plants growing on the side of the road. And they go, oh, look, I can see that this one is above the other. I go like, oh, you know, maybe if I manage that one in that way, that would happen. You know, you start to just observing how everything around you is moving, like, you know, like I've described. It's quite interesting.
Is this going to be an online course, do you think, or?
Yeah, look, I'm in the process of developing an online course as well. And so that's going to be a physical course from the 1st to the 5th of April. So that's our kind of autumn. And then I have a couple of friends that I'm going to ask them to record what I'm saying. And then I'm hoping to turn that material into a long online course, but a course that is not like a self-guided one that you just buy and run away. but a course that I will actually go and I will guide people on a weekly basis. So I'm thinking, I'm not sure at the moment, I'll see how the content will be, but something between a 6 to 12 week course in which we meet maybe for 2 hours on a Saturday, have a bit of a presentation, share projects, because I want a lot of communication between the participants so we can start to change ideas and group people together. Oh, you're from the US, me too. Or, you know, I'm from Tampa, you're from Tampa, let's work together. So that cross-pollination starts to work. And then we start to hopefully, because, you know, it's such a powerful tool, the online course, that I think if we start to harness that proper, and what I want to do is get people excited to try and then somehow facilitate the communication. That's all. You know, I'm not going to tell you that you're going to plan this and this and this because I can't tell you. You are the only person that can tell you what you're going to do. But I'm hoping to present some of those ideas and present how I've done, how I put those ideas into my practice, into my context, so you can start to connect some of your dots to do it. And then the most important part is once you've done it, you come back to the community and say, hey, I thought about this, I did that, that worked, that didn't, I think it was because of this, so next time I'm going to do that, why you reckon, oh, I think that, and then we start to talk reality. Because a lot of the talk that I see in permaculture and syntropic farming is very conceptual. It's like, oh, I think this is the perfect consortium. You put this plant in 30 days and 60 days and 90 days. We have to understand that these are just guidelines. You know, these are just guidelines to help you move. But, you know, reality is very different. You know, you get too much rain, not enough rain, pest attacks, couldn't buy fertilizer, the car broke down, the tractor is not working, mom's screaming, the wife is crazy, whatever that you need to bring into your context and make it happen. That I can't tell you how you're going to do it.
I'm really excited about your courses to come out. I think that's a great idea, especially the online one. Even the in-person is probably, you know, it's just a different experience, I guess. I hope in the in-person one you are going to have some food for the people, you know, some fresh harvest.
Absolutely. That's the plan. That's the plan. And that's another thing that I try to offer, because you go and do those permaculture courses and the food you get, it's food from the supermarket.
Oh.
So I'm trying to grow as much as I can. I probably won't be able to offer everything, 100%, but, you know, but I'm offering 100% organic food, 100% Australian grown, and as local as I can source as well. So I'm trying to bring that element, you know, the importance of that element as well. Yeah. So that'll be nice. Should be a good course, I hope.
No, yeah, I'm excited. Definitely send that over to me. I'll help promote it for sure. That'll be awesome. Well, Victor.
Yeah, it's on the website. It's on the Syntropic Garden website. On the immersive course or something like that. And the online course is that as well, but it's just more of a overview of what I'm thinking. But I'm hoping, I think the website I'm saying that I'll be doing on in March, but it's looking more like April because I'm going to be now using the physical course as material for the online course, because I think that's going to be important. So we're looking more into an April, maybe early May, online course.
Happy. Cool. That's exciting, yeah. Man.
Very.
So before I let you go, I want to know, are there any like favorite foods you like to make with the things you grow, or maybe even is there like a Brazilian traditional real food recipe that you can recommend?
Yep. Well, look, I'm a big fan of cassava. Do you know cassava?
I know what it is. I've never really used it. Yeah.
Yep. Well, it's such a beautiful plant. You know, it's one of those, it takes about a year to grow them. So it's a root crop, very starchy. And it kind of subtropical and tropical climates, you know, the go-to plants that you can just put a stick in the ground and, you know, a year later you might have, you know, big roots and they're so yummy. So very traditional in Brazil and I think in the Pacific Islands as well. Southeast Asia probably have a fair bit as well of that. And there is one traditional recipe which Ernest brings in his website or something. I think you can find it, which is a traditional recipe that he found in some indigenous group in Brazil, which is called an Indian bread. And it's super simple. All you do is you get the cassava and you just roughly peel it, just run your knife just to get that kind of brown skin, grate as fine as you can. And then that grated material, you squeeze it, get out as much of the juice out of it. So you get just this kind of fiber. And then you get the fiber packed into a jar, really well packed all the way to the top, close the lid, let it ferment for, you know, a week or two or whatever. So you have this beautiful sour kind of smell and taste. And basically you have kind of a rough flour, let's say. And then you just get, and then, oh, it's beautiful. It's a, the best pizza base you can have. Basically, all you got to do is get a frying pan, no oil, no nothing. Just get that crumb, sprinkle across, press it, you know, 3 or 4 minutes on it, put a topping on, put a lid on. See you later. Very good, very easy, and super nutritious.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah, simple and nutritious and real food, whole food. That's what I'm all about. So that's a good one.
And to continue with the juice that you got out of that, because you squeeze out the water, you let that water sit for a couple of hours. So the tapioca will then separate from the water. So you can just throw that water out, or you can still save the water. And then the tapioca, you let it dry and becomes that very, very fine powdery thing. You just put it in your mortar and pestle, and then you have tapioca flour, which you can make little pancakes by itself, or you can bake with that, whatever. And then the liquid, you can just let it ferment as well. It becomes this beautiful, sweet, sour aroma, and you can cook a very nice chicken in that.
Ooh, that sounds amazing.
Cool use of a beautiful plant.
Love it. Absolutely. Man, thank you so much for coming on. That was awesome. I learned so much from you today. And, you know, I'm on this mission to just explore as much of this regenerative farming as possible. And I see this is like one type of it, or maybe even, you know, I mean, maybe this is it. You know, you use the ultimate like strategy to create more life exponentially, you know? So, while regenerating soil, and yeah, it just it sounds great, and you have the results to show it, right? So that's awesome.
Absolutely, yeah, it's beautiful, and I think bringing holistic management with that, it makes it even nicer if you want to play with animals. Then, you know, a syntropic holistic management system, I think, would be very powerful.
Yeah, eventually bring animals into the system. That's something I'm sure that they still have to figure out how to do. Or is there much out there like that?
Not too much. I mean, you're starting to see a few, you know, trees among the pasture and working in that kind of sense. There's a few people trying to bring animals into those, you know, making bigger rows and things like that. It's definitely doable. And I think holistic management has a lot of the answers in terms of the animal management. It's just kind of finding that synchronicity and bringing them together. And I think it can be very powerful. Absolutely. We've got the information. We need is more people to have the courage to go out and say, look, I'm just going to do a little trial just to see what happens, you know, just to see. Just the curiosity. That's what we need. People that are curious to just see what's possible. And then I think we're moving in the right direction.
Absolutely. Cool. So people can find you on syntropicgardener.com, right? That's the best way. Do you have a social media, like an Instagram or anything that you run?
Oh, I'm still learning on the social media. There is a Facebook page, Syntropic Gardener Facebook. And I've just now created a little YouTube channel where I'm hoping to be putting some videos. There will be a video upload today talking about that syntropic worldview. And I'm contemplating Instagram, but I just have to work on the land at the moment that I'm kind of going, maybe it's a winter project for me.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Cool. Maybe I can have you on some other time in the future, talk about the urban gardening there. I have a bunch of questions for that too. That'd be cool. But yeah, I really appreciate you coming on and us connecting. This is awesome.
Great. Thanks a lot for the opportunity. I hope your audience enjoys it and learns a bit. And most importantly, get the work done.
Get the work
done. Let's get moving. Let's get talking. That's it.
Love
it. No more talking. Let's get our hands dirty like mine.
I love that. All right, man. We'll stay in touch. And yeah, good luck with the online courses. Like I said, send me those. I'll help promote them.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks a lot for your work. And have a good rest.
You too. See you later, man.
Thank you. See you, man. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, everybody, that is it for today. If you do get value from this podcast, please don't forget to subscribe and rate it with a 5-star written review on Apple Podcast. This is how we can grow the show and bring the message about real food and the processes that bring it to the table to more foodies like you and I. Also, like I said, feel free to follow me on Instagram. Again, that's at Paul D. Wieland. I'm happy to engage in some conversation, so just send me a DM with any questions that you have. And if you don't have Instagram, that's all right. We also have Facebook and Twitter. Just search for Year of Plenty Podcasts on those platforms or use the links in the podcast episode description and give it a follow. Like I said, send me a DM. I'm happy to answer the questions that I can answer. And I'm happy to just have conversations with you about real food. You know, we learn best from each other, I think, and everyone has their stories to tell and their unique points of view, so the more the merrier. And one more thing I want to say is that I'm now doing a weekly newsletter with 3 interesting food-related things that I learned during the week. So if you want to get that email with that list and those links, go over to the website, which is www.theyearofplenty.com. Sign up for it. There'll be like a little pop-up window, and you'll receive that weekly newsletter. Thank you so much for listening and supporting the podcast. Until next time, my friends, let's keep exploring real food together.